evening and welcome to you in Radioland wherever you are. Tonight, a rather different show. Tonight will be, for me, a journey of discovery about my own father-in-law, a man who I never met. A remarkable man who was a musician, a TV host, an influential painter. His name was Rory McEwen.
My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pines, where the sun never shines, and I shiver the whole night through. My husband was a hard-working man, killed a mile from here. His head was found in the driving wheel, and his body never has been found. My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? In the pines, where the sun never shines, and I shiver the whole night through. My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night? You caused me to weep, and you caused me to moan, and you caused me to leave my home. My girl, where will you go? I'm a-going where the cold winds blow. In the pines, where the sun never shines, and I shiver the whole night through.
And in the studio tonight to help me explore the life of the late Rory McEwen, I have some amazing guests. I have the author of White Mischief, the author of Keith Richards' most recent biography. I have James Fox, yes, ladies and gentlemen. Yeah. We have England's greatest folk musician in the form of Martin Carthy.
Yes, sir.
All people who knew and worked with him. And one-time Minister for the Arts and a great big marvellous poet, Lord Grey Gowrie. Yes. But first of all, on the telephone, all the way from Ireland, we have one of the greatest legends of music. We have Van Morrison. Yes. So, Van, the first question is really, when did you first hear Rory McEwen?
I was just, you know, when I was a kid, I was at school, and there was this program with Cliff Mitchellmore. It had various folk singers, Rory, and it had Cy Grant and Robin Hall, sometimes Robin Hall, Jimmy McGregor. Rory was on quite a bit, I remember, and he used to write topical calypsos about the news that day, the current news.
Wow.
And apparently he was, you know, writing them that day and then performing them that night, so... As well as that, he also did, you know, some Lead Belly stuff. And sometimes he did a sort of spot with Alec as well. Rory and Alec did a song together, usually a Scottish folk song.
And did that inspire you to sort of do music yourself a bit?
Oh, absolutely, yeah, because my father had bought a Lead Belly album, well, several Lead Belly albums, actually, and that's what I was listening to at the time. And, you know, I couldn't really actually believe that somebody was actually doing Lead Belly on TV. It's sort of like, so that was one of those pivotal moments, I suppose, you know.
I mean, it does seem unbelievable even now that somebody... And tonight was one of the most popular shows on the television then, to be doing Lead Belly on mainstream TV.
Yeah, well, a lot of people from that era remember Rory and remember this, but it seems like the music journalists have totally neglected him over the past 50 years or so, you know?
Well, it's great that we were able to write him back in.
It was shortly after that you know, Dunnigan had the hit with Rock Island Line. So, I mean, I just couldn't believe it, because here I was, this kid, listening to Lead Belly, and then, yeah, Rory does Lead Belly, and then all of a sudden Dunnigan has a hit with Lead Belly. So I just couldn't believe it. I was, you know, right in there, you know.
That's amazing, really.
So I had my first skiffle group when I was in school.
All because of Rory, sort of thing, in many ways.
Well, yeah, he was a key factor, key figure, yeah. And I don't understand why he's like being sort of left out.
Thank you very much indeed, Van Morrison. Now let's get the program going and let's hear a bit of Rory McKeown playing a bit of that Lead Belly with Ella Speed. McKeown and others, and I'm joined by the others that I spoke of earlier in this show. Yes, James Fox is here, Gray Gower is here, and Martin Carter is here. So let me start off by asking James, what were we hearing there? Who were we hearing there, first of all?
We were hearing Rory McKeown on the 12-string guitar, Martin Carthy, who is here with us,
excellent.
And Lisa Turner on the 5-string banjo, and he's singing a song called Ella Speed, which is a Lead Belly song. And this was Rory at his best, really. Just brilliant 12-string guitar playing, which is something that he'd learnt a long time ago.
And Martin, had there been a lot of 12-string... Had the 12-string guitar featured much in sort of English music up until this point?
Absolutely not. I can remember being at school in the 50s, and one of my classmates came in very excited because he'd watched the Tonight Show the previous evening, and he'd said, "There was a man on, and he was playing a 12-string guitar." And we were all about four or five of us. No. And they said, "No, honestly, it was a 12-string guitar, and he was called Rory McQueen." I mean, that was the first I'd ever heard of a 12-string guitar.
Mm. Au contraire, really.
Mm. Yeah, and that's how the strange it is that now a programme like The Tonight Show, was it called The Tonight Show?
It was just called Tonight.
Tonight, right. And that was the most popular show on at the time. I mean, it had millions and millions of viewers when there weren't lots of things, there weren't lots of channels, so everybody was watching that one show. And what time was it going out?
6:30, I think. 7 o'clock, right. 6:30, 7 o'clock.
Yeah, it was right there. Mm. It was before you had to go to bed, basically.
Annoying sort of programme. And so let's go back down the time tunnel. And James, where did sort of the music thing start for Rory McKeown?
Well, he was brought up in this vast Palladian house in Scotland. And in the nursery, his older brother, he had five brothers, was exceptionally for that time a great jazz fanatic. And he had all these 78s in the nursery in some back upstairs distant room. And one of these was the recordings of Leadbelly done in 1948. And from that moment, I suppose his childhood, he wanted to get a 12-string guitar. It took him 15 years, maybe, and finally he found one when he went to America, and that was it. But Leadbelly, he said in one of the things that he wrote, was spoke to his heart from the time of childhood, that and the American blues, black blues.
And he said, Leadbelly was like a companion to him, although he'd never met him. I thought it was a lovely way of looking at a musician that you loved, you know, that you hear their music and it becomes your friend and your companion as you're going along.
Yes, and he took it. Leadbelly went deep into his soul. You can hear it in his playing. He took him. He loved his music. He loved him as a character, as he loved all those kind of. And so he was the real thing. Nobody played Leadbelly or interpreted Leadbelly in the way Rory did.
Now, it's quite unusual. So he went to America earlier on with his brother, and that was quite an unusual thing to do, wasn't it, really? And go across looking for their heroes. When was this? And this was in the sort of
this was about early 50s? About 1955. By this time, Rory and Alex McKeown were a kind of... They used to go around to Deb Balls and things and play at parties and stuff like that. This was before the skiffle thing. And they went to America to literally play their way across the United States, playing for money. But they also met Leadbelly's widow, who showed Rory his 12-string guitar. They met Blind Gary Davis, who was maybe the greatest picker of the sort of Carolina-style blues and stuff. And that was a dream. I mean, they just fell in with all these musicians instantly.
Because nowadays, lots of people, it's like a sort of a tourist trail. You know, you go to Memphis and New Orleans and all these places. It's like a thing that lots of people do. It's marvellous for them, which is great. But they were really, must have been some of the first music tourists.
Yeah, well, one story I do remember is they were barred by the Musicians Union in America until, you know, being a elite Catholic Scottish family, they managed to put money in the right place and all was solved. So they got this great gig in Kansas City after that, lasted for several days.
And what happened when they got back? So that was that they were off learning all this music and getting to the heart of the music they loved.
Well, they were so far ahead of their time, playing Leadbelly, knowing the blues and so on. This was, you know, as I said before, skiffle. In the year they were away, Lonnie Donegan had produced Rock Island Line, which triggered the whole thing, triggered the folk thing, the skiffle thing, and so on. So that was 56, I think, when that record came out, 55 or 56. So they came back, and everything had changed. There were, you know, folk clubs, R&B clubs were sprouting up all over the place. So he fitted into that because he could play all this stuff.
And how did you first meet him, Martin?
I think I first saw him down at the Troubadour in Earl's Court, and that would be in the early 60s, 61, 62 maybe. I remember walking down into the Troubadour and hearing this sound, walking through the door, looking to the left, as you did, and he was playing this song on the 12th string, and he just opened up with, how did it start? Johnson, he was riding along as fast as he could ride, thought he heard a woman cry. Johnson's getting off his horse, searching the woods all around. There he spied a woman lie with her hair pinned to the ground.
Blimey.
It's a wonderful, wonderful song, and he's playing that roaring along on the 12th string because he was wonderful.
And as well as having the as well as being influenced by the blues, they were very they did a lot of Scottish folk music as well, didn't they? Did you do that with them as well?
We did one or two. We did a thing called the Battle of Sheriff Moor. Did one or two, but basically what we stuck to was Leadbelly and the odd thing that Lisa knew.
But actually, he was also, they researched a lot of, you know, Scottish songs. They did two albums for folkways of Scottish songs, and that started a whole new thing as well. A lot of other singers came up and made that popular and so on. So they were deep into the archive, as it were, of their own Scottish music background.
Well, the folk scene at that time was really, really small, and there was quite a lot of infighting going on, but they would go to one of the very first, what they call themselves, a really serious folk club, which was Ewan McColl's Ballads and Blues Club at the Princess Louise, and which is in High Holborn, and it's still there. And the Princess Louise is sort of an iconic thing for folkies, and that started, I suppose, in the mid-50s. And there are photographs of Rory and Alex playing Ewan McColl and Bert Lloyd sitting in the background. The days when people actually did talk to each other, even if they weren't comfortable with each other, they talked to each other and they sang together. But then things began to fragment, which is a shame.
Yeah, I mean, because some people liked electric music, some people like non-electric music. It's very difficult, isn't it?
Oh, it got electric music was the music of Satan to yeah. Oh, seriously.
We're going to play Banks of Sicily next. Tell us about where this comes from.
Well, it's written by Hamish Henderson, who was the doyen of the School of Scottish Studies, also a collector and a singer, as long as you were in a room about the size of a matchbox. He's a beautiful singer. He couldn't sing loudly. And he was a poet, a wonderful poet. And he wrote this song about the landings at Anzio, specifically the 51st Highland Division, in which he was an officer, left Sicily and landed at Anzio. And he had all sorts of stories about that, but he wrote this wonderful song, Farewell You Banks of Sicily.
And so I think, well, who's singing on this one? There's Rory and Alex McEwan and
Carolyn Hester.
Yeah.
And Dick Farina, who later became Richard Farina.
Let's hear that lovely song and bring back those memories with Banks of Sicily.
The pipey is dozy, the pipey is fey, he will ne be ruined for his vino the day. The sky o'er Messina is unco and grey, and a' the brech chomas are eerie.
Fair will ye banks of Sicily, fair ye will ye valley and shaw, we jump among the kyles ye pale bloody sward is a weary.
Then doon the stair and line the water side, wait your turn, the fair is a wall. Then doon the stair and line the water side, or the brick chomas are eerie.
Fair will ye banks of Sicily, fair ye will ye valley and shaw. Smur the wilds, ye bloody swaddies are weary.
The drummy is polished, the drummy is braw, he canna be seen for his web in the bar. He's beezed himself up for a 40 and aught to leave with his Lola his dearie.
Fair will ye dives of Sicily, fair ye will ye sheelin' and haw, we'll mind she beans and both is what kind signorinas were cheery.
Then tune the pipes and drub the tenor drum, leave your kit the side of the wall. Then tune the pipes and drub the tenor drum, or the brick chomas are eerie.
Ye dives of Sicily, fair ye will, ye sheelin' and haw, we'll mind she beans and bark.
What an enchanting sort of record. Took me off into the sort of Scottish hills and I was hearing it. It's lovely. That was Rory McEwan. And if you've just joined us, we're looking into the life and the world of Rory McEwan, the great folk artist, and then a man that stopped all that and became a great painter, which we'll be going into. And we're talking with our guests here, the phenomenal author of White Mischief and Keith Richards' recent biography, Mr. James Fox, is here with us. Lord Gowrie, the ex-minister of arts, is with us. And England's greatest folk musician in the form of Martin Carthy is with us. Well, Gary, also a great poet, of course. So it's, we've got a, an esteemed guest list to talk about Rory McKeown. And so the record I was going to play earlier, of course, was there was Johnny Cope. Where does that fit into the whole scheme of things?
Well, the McKeown brothers, Rory and Alex McKeown, were known just as well for... but mainly, perhaps, for their Scottish folk songs that they sang. And they had this song, Johnny Cope, one of their repertoire. It's about the Jacobite Rebellion. They had several songs about that. And clearly, they were on that side, you could tell.
So how old would this song be, then, do you think?
High Johnny Cope would be the Jacobite period. So don't get me on dates, Jules, but, you know.
Vaguely speaking, vaguely. Century-wise.
It's the Battle of Preston Pans, the
18th century.
Jacobite
18th century.
Yeah,
18th century. Well, that's what we need. Exactly.
Just one.
Yeah.
Thanks,
Ray Gary, straight in with the period. Thank you for clarifying.
Thank you,
Roger. That, yes. Yeah. Exactly, good. An 18th century song, so it's so would they have collected this, or was this a well-known song, Martin?
Fairly well-known, fairly well-known. To people who were interested in Scottish song, it was a fairly well-known song.
Yeah, and once you met them, by the way, so did you go and perform with them quite often? Did you sort of become almost a group, as in a group with Rory, so to
speak?
Well,
we had that little trio because of Hullabaloo. The first few shows were individuals, and Rory, or maybe under the guidance of the director, who was a man called Ben Churchill, put this group together with Lisa and me.
Well, we'll talk about Hullabaloo in a moment, because that is an amazing television programme, and that's another whole raft of stuff that happened in the extraordinary life of Rory McKeown, so we'll talk about that in a moment.
But can I say also that the trio they had, Rory, it shows how brief Rory's... career was, but they were absolutely brilliant. People thought they were better, Martin, Rory, and Lisa, than the Weavers. They were extremely good, and it's one of those things you think, if only, etc. But it all
did they introduce their Scottish songs to the great Americans they were hanging around with, like the Rev Gary Davis and so on?
I don't know.
Good question. Yeah,
we've got a lot of great musical scholarship in this room. Anyone come up with that?
I wonder.
I think is the answer to that question.
Yeah, but I bet
I don't think
it
travelled to Harlem. Actually, the Scottish song.
But be interesting. Yeah.
It would have been interesting if they had have done, I suppose. Yeah. And am I right in thinking, whilst we're just on that subject, when they were in America, didn't they appear on the Ed Sullivan Show?
They did twice, in fact. They appeared.
I mean, that's
the
kind of Beatlemania stuff,
it is,
isn't
it? It's huge.
It's
that shows how and people thought this is extraordinary. These two guys from Scotland. You don't just drift off to America and find yourself on, the Ed Sullivan Show. It was phenomenal.
And what music did they do when they were on the Ed Sullivan Show? Do we know?
That's a good point. I don't know what they sang. There would have been a Scottish song. It might have been Johnny Cope. That would be perfect for the Ed
Sullivan
Show.
They weren't posing as simple Southern boys.
No, they couldn't do that.
That was such a what a
that
great
was beyond their range.
What a great idea, though. So in fact, they were bringing the Scottish folk music to an American audience. That's an incredible thing to do, isn't it? You know. So let's hear what this might be the sort of thing they would have done on the Ed Sullivan Show.
Cope sent a challenge, Fred and Bar, cheerily meet me and ye door, and I'll learn you the earth's a war if you meet me in the morning. Hi, Johnny Cope, are you walking yet? Are your drums a-beating yet? If he were walking, I would wait the gang to the coals in the morning. When Cheerly looked this letter upon, he drew his sword, the scabbard from, come follow me, my merry men, we'll meet Johnny Cope in the morning. Hey, Johnny Cope, are you walking yet? Or are your drums a-beating yet? If he were walking, I would wait the gang to the coals in the morning. When Johnny Cope heard of this, he thought it wouldn't be amiss to hire a horse in readiness for to flee away in the morning. Hey, Johnny Cope, are you walking yet? Or are your drums a-beating yet? If he were walking, I would wait the gang to the coals in the morning. When Johnny Cope to Berwick came, they speared at him, was all your men. The deal confound me, can I ken? I left them all this morning. Hey, Johnny Cope, are you walking yet? Or are your drums a-beating yet? If he were walking, I would wait the gang to the coals in the morning. Do Johnny, be as good's your word, and try your faith with fire and sword, and then I flee a wall like a frickin' bird, as chase his nest in the morning. Hey, Johnny Cope, are you walking yet? Or are your drums a-beating yet? If he were walking, I would wait to gang to the coals in the morning.
Oh, Johnny Troth, you weren't blate to leave your men in sick or straight and come with the news of your own defeat, say early in the morning. Hey, Johnny Cole, are you walking yet? Are your drums a-beating yet? If you are walking, I would wait to gang to the Coles in the morning.
Go on, oh Johnny, get up and rend your heel and bagpipes, mark a den. It's best to sleep in a hail skin, for it will be a bloody morning.
Hey, Johnny Cole, are you walking yet? Are your drums a-beating yet? If you were walking, I would wait to gang to the Coles in the morning. In faith, poor Johnny, I got sick flags with a claymores and filler bags. If I meet them again, they'll break my legs. I wish ye all good morning. Hey, Johnny Cole, are you walking yet? Are your drums a-beating yet? If you were walking, I would wait to gang to the Coles in the morning.
Rory and Alex McKeown there with Johnny Cope, and we're talking and discussing the music of Rory McKeown and his life, his extraordinary life, where he was there on the Ed Sullivan Show, yeah, and then came back to England, and then came back to Britain and started his own television show, Hullabaloo, which was an incredible show and nothing like anybody had seen before, really. What sort of artists did they have on Hullabaloo?
They had anybody who was on the British folk scene at the time,
and really, the blues scene as well.
And well, it was very interesting because there was a resident band led by Cyril Davis, and the lead singer was Long John Baldry, and they were a great band. I mean, John was a great singer, great performer.
And I remember you once saying that was like it was the only program that's because it's. Just as the Beatles are sort of changing sort of the way music goes and everything, but it was really the program that had the only alternative. The alternative music of the time that wasn't the chart music was blues and folk music, and this was a window into it, which is what made it very unusual, didn't it?
Yes, and it had R&B as well. It was the very beginning of the sort of rock and roll stuff as well, so it really had everything. And the thing you probably won't mention, Jules, but the fact is that it was a precursor of your later. It was almost
exactly
the same format.
It has world music, it has music, yeah, from all different sorts of things in it. Did you ever see the show, Grey?
I never saw it. Well, I saw it on television. Mm. I mean, I saw them on the Tonight Show and so on. But I got to know Rory through his brother called David, who was known as Gummi.
Oh, yeah.
And Gummi was a languid and interesting fellow. And I hung around because Gummi was insanely attractive, as indeed was Rory, to girls. And you got Gummi's cast-offs from time to time. So that was, you know, a nice way in.
Yeah.
But I was more in a way of a groupie about painting and painters. This is now in the 60s. And I got to know Rory when he had taken up painting, and
he'd
I thought
always
him very remarkable.
Throughout his career as a musician, but he'd always painted and drawn at home, hadn't he, I think? And
yes, I think he'd had a very good teacher, I think, called Nigel Wykes, who was a botanical artist. And botanical artist is a very odd genre. We've been talking about musical genres, because you're in the hands of botanical anoraks, and you've got to be accurate, and it's a very big strain on the eyes. I had staying with me once a famous botanical artist called Paul Jones, and he was always weeping in tears, you know, because of you have to concentrate so quickly, and then the blooms can go off, and you've got to work rather fast in this watchmaking way. But the interesting thing about Rory is he ticked all the boxes about how you must be accurate, and, you know, a botanical expert must be able to identify your plant. But he swung them. They lifted off. And when I was first working, I think, in the art trade, early 70s, I bought a good, big, important Rory. And he knew it was very expensive for me. It was £1,200, which was a lot at the time. And, you know, above my kind of pay grade. And as a result, when he and Ramona used to come to supper with my wife and me, they wrote a thank you letter, which was the most beautiful original work on vellum of a plant, with thank you, Gray and Nighty, for a lovely evening. And that's a great treasure.
Ooh, what a lovely
of mine
thing for him to do.
But he was an enormously attractive, stylish, magical human being, really.
Well, we'll come on to that again in a moment. I'm going to just talk about the television programme Hullabaloo again, which, as you said, James, was like a precursor of later, because it wasn't about the mainstream music. It was about the things that were great. They had world music, blues music, all these different things. And I think on one of the shows, Martin, and you were on all the shows, weren't you, singing with them?
I was on the bulk of the... Well, I was on all the early shows, and there were oddments after that, which I wasn't necessarily.
And they had
on.
All sorts of interesting guests. For instance, Sonny Boy Williamson, yes. I saw was on one of the. Do you remember him coming on?
I remember him coming on. This enormously tall man with this. Seemed he had a beard. It was quite long, but it seemed to be about two hairs. and he had a bowler hat. He was all dressed in black. And he was astonishing.
He didn't have many teeth, did he?
He didn't have many. Well, he had a few. Not very many. Yeah. Not very many teeth.
And Eck, Rory's brother, when he was alive, told me that when he came on the show, Sonny Boy Williamson, they went to have chats with him. Rory went to sort of say, hello, everything all right in the dressing room? You've got everything you need. And he opened his bag, and in his bag he had a silver revolver, and that was all he had in there.
That's right, he did, yeah.
And yes. No further questions.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, he showed it to a couple of people in the studio. Yes, people were taken aback.
But the idea I get, I never met Rory McKeown, but the idea I get, as well as him being a musician, influence and an artistic influence, that he was just a very charming person and would have charmed lots of people into. And so Sonny Boy Williamson, although he might have had a sort of revolver in his case, he wasn't going to use it because Rory was such a nice fellow to everybody. Yeah,
yes. Right. He was extraordinarily attracted to Lisa Turner. I do remember that, who was this tiny 4'11" tall banjo player, and she was the sweetest person you've ever met. And he was, yes, to put it, to say the least, extraordinarily attractive.
Sonny Boy Williamson was on his way.
Was on his way. My goodness, yes. So,
I think we could play a Sonny Boy Williamson. Yes. I remember I've seen the stuff on Hullabaloo, and it's great. All of the things on Hullabaloo are great. It's one of the most important musical archives that there are in television of music at that time, because nobody else was capturing that music. But here is Don't Start Me Talking.
Going down to Rosie, stopping Fannie Mae. Gonna tell her Fannie what I heard. A boyfriend said, don't start me talking. I'll tell her everything I know. I'm gonna break up this signifying, cause somebody's got to go. Jack give his wife $2, go downtown and get some mocking. Gets out on the streets. Old George stopped her. He knocked her down and black in the eye. She gets back home. Tell her husband a lie. Don't start me talking. I'll tell everything I know. I'm gonna break up this signifying. Somebody's got to go. Borrowed some money, go to the beauty shop. She honked his horn, she began to stop. Said, take me, baby, around the block. I'm going to the beauty shop where I can get my hair side. Don't stop me talking, I'll tell everything I know. Well, to break up this evening fine.
It's a good point Gray made as well about his attractiveness. He had this extraordinary ability to connect with people, Rory, which is...
It wasn't at all a sort of thrusting charm which some of his other brothers had, but it was, he was very quiet,
yes,
and ironic. I hadn't seen him for a bit. This was near the end of his life, and he wasn't at all well. And I said, "How have you been?" And he said, "Oh, not too good, just a whiff of cancer." That was a chilling and wonderful, but he said it very lightly, and we talked about something else. But I wanted to say one more thing about him in terms of painting. Botanical art can be recondite, can be a specialist kind of field, but Rory deservedly was taken seriously by serious artists in the general arena. And he was a friend of two people I admired and knew, David Hockney and Ron Kitai, who were big forces in the 1960s, and indeed still. Kitai gone now. And Rory had a great, one of the, David Hockney's greatest paintings, The Room Tarzana, which is a sort of gay parody of the Boucher, Miss O'Murphy picture of a girl showing her bum on a bed. And this was a boy showing his bum on a bed. But it's a terrific picture. And I've always followed what's happened to it since. It's just recently been resold again. And it was wonderful and very much Rory's strong taste, because one thinks of botanical artists as being perhaps a little bit delicate. Not at all. He liked these kind of strong paintings.
And had lots of modern contemporary artists at the time were his friends, Jim Dine, who's a...
Yes, absolutely.
American,
Jim Dine
David
was a big
Hockney,
mate, I know.
And it's interesting how he's spanning all of these worlds. And now the next thing we're going to play is Poor Howard Is Dead. Tell us where this one comes from.
It's another Lead Belly song, I do believe. interesting. I didn't know Lead Belly's work terribly well until I met and played with Rory. So... just, I suppose, 80% of our repertoire was Lead Belly. This one I didn't know at all.
Oh,
Paul Howard is dead and gone. Rory McKeown with Martin Carthy and Lisa Turner on, in that case. And I'm delighted to say, discussing the extraordinary life and times of Rory McKeown with us in the studio are England's greatest folk musician, who is here with us, Martin Carthy. Yes. Poet and ex-minister of arts, Grey Gowrie, is with us. Great author of a recent biography on Keith Richards and White Mischief, and much else. But Mr. James Fox is with us. Yes. Discussing their friend Rory McKeown. So you were just saying there, Martin, that when you were doing the programme Hullabaloo, and there was the house band of Cyril Davis and his Rhythm and Blues All-Stars, and all these different world music people came on, Rory got on very well with all of them.
He loved, everybody loved him. You know, the central core of that show was made up of people who loved him. Cyril Davis is a great example. Cyril was the world's fussiest musician. He knew how Lead Belly ought to be played, and he wasn't about to listen to anybody like the trio that we had doing it all wrong. And he at one point insisted that he and Rory did one song on their own, and it was fantastic. But Cyril loved Rory. Mm. He knew that Rory could do it right.
And his painting is incredible, because a lot of people say, well, before that, Botanic, he also did Botanic works on a large scale. Nobody had really done, people hadn't blown the things up. And when you look at the paintings, and we better show one, haven't we? If you tune into the website, where is that website, Dave? I always forgot to mention that.
It's bbc.co.uk/radio2.
Beautifully said.
Thank
there.
You.
And if you do that, you can see what we all look like. And also, you can see one of Rory's pictures and a picture of what we're talking about. So he really concentrated then on painting, and I think it's unusual for somebody to go from one thing to another like that and then be really, really a success.
Really good at it. And remember how young he was when he died. He was just 50, and he had a retrospective full show at the Serpentine Gallery, I think shortly after his death. I'd have to check that, but I think it wasn't very long after, and it was just wonderful work. You know, and I do want to sort of underline a bit that Rory transcends this medium. He's not simply a botanical artist. He's part of the remarkable history of English kind of 60s painting, like Hockney and Kitaj and others, and Lucian Freud. He's a small, intense, original, general artist who happened, instead of doing nudes or animals, to do plants. But he's not simply a botanical artist.
Mm. And they are incredible, aren't they? They come from somewhere else altogether.
Yeah.
And you can see those if you go to Kew Gardens. Now, actually, I was going to ask you, while you're here, Greg, just on a separate note, because it gives us an excuse to play something, and we're going to come back in a moment, and we're going to play one of Rory's songs that he wrote. Mm. But it's just a great story, because I'm a big fan of Pete Johnson. And although this isn't really related to Rory, I know he was a Boogie Woogie fan, because I've got his Boogie Woogie records. and in fact, I'm going to play one of it, which is, this record was owned by Rory. But Pete Johnson, who was one of the inventors of Boogie Woogie, really, you caught up with him, didn't you, later in life, when you were at university in America, I think.
Well, this is my one, in this company, I say with great humility and anxiety, is my one sort of sub-footnote in the history of music, which is that I was a young don teacher of American literature, especially American poetry was what I knew about, at the State University of New York at Buffalo, up on Lake Erie. And this was early 60s, 63, 64, and it was a very, very segregated town, but I'd got a gifted black student who took me into some of the R&B clubs and so on. And quite fortuitously, I found out that the great Pete Johnson, a hero of my teenage years and still, as a boogie-woogie pianist, and when I met Jules, we rather bonded over Pete Johnson, was living broke, poor, ignored, forgotten, and ill, diabetic, I think, in Buffalo. Now, the university was a great musical center in kind of modern classical music, had premieres of Stockhausen and things like that. And I managed to persuade the university to pull this elderly guy out of retirement. He wouldn't play, but they put on a big concert in his honor and got him some money. So,
thank goodness for that.
That was something.
Yes, here, here, here. Well, let's there's an interesting story for the about the end of Pete Johnson, and here is one of Rory's records of Pete Johnson. After this, we're actually going to play some music here in the studio of Rory's. Here's Pete Johnson. Johnson playing there, Sunset Romp, one of Rory McKeown's records. Same Pete Johnson that dear Grey Gary managed to get a benefit for, really, at the University in America. And we've been discussing Rory McKeown here in the studio this evening with our lovely guests, Martin Carthy, James Fox, Lord Gowrie. How marvellous for more to come in. Now we're going to play something. And the other, before we play one of Rory's songs that he wrote, how would you each sum up Rory, do you think, his personality? Because here's a man who we've heard has started in the world of folk music and then moved into painting, been a success in both, and was clearly a magnetic personality. I mean, I think that's the things I'm picking up on.
He was enormously open. He really, he saw it, I think, as his duty to help young musicians who he thought could do with just a bit of a leg up. And he certainly helped me. He just, I mean, was taken into this group with Lisa and Rory and given the opportunity to do whatever the hell I wanted. If anybody had an idea, he would embrace it straight away. And we would all give it our best. Mm. He's an unforgettable man, incredibly kind, never negative. Mm. I never heard him ever be negative. And talking about changing from one thing to another, if I may, he left folk music and embraced painting, but he also completely changed his style. I remember going to see him at Tregunta Road one time. I've changed my style, and he'd begun to do 3D art. Mm.
Perspex, yeah.
Yes, that's it. And I found really hard to get my head round the fact that there was this thing, and he moved so far away, it seemed to me, from this really delicate stuff, but this had its own delicacy, I'm sure. But I found it bewildering that he was able to make that, what seemed to me, to be a huge jump.
And he must have been a magnetic character, because at his home in Tregunta Road, which you were mentioning there, Martin, James, there were lots of people gathered there. George Harrison, Ravi Shankar lived at the end of his garden, didn't he, in a sort of house at the end of his garden. And there were all these people constantly around the house, sort of artists and musicians all the time. You know?
So did Carolyn. Carolyn lived there for a while, I think.
Yeah, there was an extraordinary combination of people. And he was the facilitator of that period of extraordinary energy when all the arts were sort of combining into one river, as it were. You know, things were happening in all these different areas. And he was perfectly placed for that in his house. And, you know, there'd be Barbara Streisand and Bob Dylan in the same room. It's kind of very 60s, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Very proper happening going on.
All that stuff. And the other thing about him is he had a brilliant wit. He was very, very funny. He had an extraordinary gift of parody, of satire, very quick, very lively, and terrific laughing and so on. And he was incredibly attentive and sweet to young people, including myself. As a teenager, I would kind of go around there, and he would never tire of showing me how he played and so on, you know, which is very sweet of him, I thought.
Which is very good, because we're going to get you to play something of his in a moment with Martin. Gray,
he was the most Shakespearean character I ever met. He was something between Benedick and Ariel. You'd need a great lightness of touch and skill to portray him right. And he had great lightness of touch and skill. It's rather hard in mere words to get some of the magic of this person.
Hmm. Well, I think between all of you, I think we've done a good job of painting some sort of a picture. And if you actually want to see the pictures, you can go to Kew Gardens, where they'll be on show. But I think now we should play a song. What song will we do, James?
Well, I thought we'd play Marilyn Monroe, this song that he wrote with or put together with Sidney Carter, who's a brilliant songwriter. And
who wrote The Lord of the Dance.
Yeah. Man who wrote Lord of a Dance, exactly, yeah.
I think this is one of his best songs, actually.
Well, thank you for joining us, it's been marvellous hearing that. We're going to hear the song now. Thank you, Martin Carthy, James Fox, Lord Dowry.
Hang on a second. To Hollywood, to Hollywood I'll go. You will know me by the name of Marilyn Monroe. Soldiers and for sailors, I'll glitter and I'll glow. They will wish they had a girl like Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn, 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 Marilyn Monroe. They put me calendar, said Marilyn Monroe. I rose and shone with nothing on except the radio. Whether I am lucky or whether I am not, I'll fight the blues, said Marilyn, with everything I've got. Marilyn, a candle in the sky wherever I may be. For those who have to walk alone and fear the dark like me. And all those lonely women, their names I'll never know. I'll glitter in the dark for them, said Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn, my hero, said Marilyn Monroe. And Arthur Miller's more like him than any man I know. Don't marry Arthur Miller, they say he's a red. They say he's an American, I'll marry him, she said. Marilyn, Marilyn, you are.
said Marilyn Monroe. It's up and down forever, my life's like the sea. And one day when I'm down, she said, will be the death of me. Marilyn, 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 Marilyn Monroe. I hear the hounds behind me, their voices I know well. Said it's more than I can tell. I hear the hounds behind me, no matter where I go. Good luck to every hunted thing, said Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn, 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 Marilyn Monroe. How long will they remember me, said Marilyn Monroe. How long will they remember me, laid me low. As long as there are people, I want you all to know, there'll never be another one like Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn, 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 Marilyn Monroe. Marilyn, 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 Marilyn Monroe.
This is BBC Radio 2, online, on digital radio, and on 88 to 91 FM.